Thank you all for joining us. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. This is our fourth annual sort of gathering jointly between CSIS and the Kaiser Family Foundation to review the outcomes of the G8 summit. We're again very grateful to Jen Cates and to Kaiser for their generosity in webcasting this particular event and for joining with us in pulling this together. This has turned out to be a very popular and very useful gathering. We're under some time pressure today because Assistant Secretary Dan Sullivan, who for the next 45 minutes will still be in the position of being the Undersecretary of State, acting Undersecretary of State, is going to need to pull out around 5 or 4 in order to be present while his new boss is sworn in. And so this was unforeseen, but he's kindly still with us, and we will rush things forward a bit. And the format we're going to pursue is we're going to ask Dan to deliver the opening set piece on his reflections as the lead Sioux Sherpa on the health issues, among others, in preparing for the G8 and carrying it forward. And then we're going to ask the German DCM, Johannes Heindl, to follow with some quick remarks. And then we'll open for question and comment so we can have some back and forth before Dan has to pull away. Jen Cates has kindly agreed to sort of have a bit of forbearance until we sort of get through that cycle, and then we'll pick up with Jen's comments and we can continue that discussion. Dan Sullivan, as I mentioned, is the Assistant Secretary for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs. He came to that position beginning in June of last year. Prior to that was at the NSC, the National Economic Council staff, where he served as director and acting senior director in the International Economics Directorate. He is a Marine Corps Infantry and Reconnaissance Officer who served in an active duty call-up in Iraq January 2005 until April 2006, where he was an advisor to the CENTCOM commander-in-chief. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, earning a bachelor's in economics, and graduated cum laude from Georgetown University, earning a JD, Master of Science in Foreign Service. We're very delighted, really, Dan, that you've taken time out to come and be with us. Johannes Heindl from the German mission came here a year ago in this position. Prior to that, served in a number of senior positions, principally focused in the prior years, going back to the late 90s, in a series of positions having to do with Eastern and Central Europe, and for the period from 94 through 98 was here in Washington. He was in one of those years detailed to the Department of State in the OSCE office. The remaining years was a political officer in the German embassy, so he's someone very familiar to Washington and very understanding of sort of how things operate here. So, Dan, without any further ado, if you could open things up for us.
Thanks very much, Steve. And I also want to thank Jennifer, Johannes, and everybody here for joining us today. I look forward to this discussion. And I really want to apologize for having to skip out a little bit early. I just recently found out that my new boss is going to get sworn in an hour. And it's going to be a small little private ceremony, and I was told to make sure that I was there, so I will be there. I apologize for that. But, again, look forward to having a discussion on what I think is a very important topic from the administration standpoint. And what I'd like to do today is just give you a little bit of a sense of the dynamics on the negotiations. As Steve mentioned, I was the Sioux Sherpa for the G8 negotiations. That's the team that works under the Sherpas, who are kind of the lead negotiators and personal representatives of the G8 leaders. So I worked very closely with Dave McCormick, our Deputy National Security Advisor, and, of course, a huge team of U.S. government officials, State Department officials, many of whom are here, who did fantastic work supporting our negotiations. I also, in the presence of the German DCM here, want to start out by complimenting the German presidency from the chancellor on down on the fantastic job that they did at the summit, shepherding us through a lot of different issues, difficult issues. I think the overall outlook, clearly from the U.S. perspective, but I think it's shared in Germany and many of the other countries, is that the Heiligendamm summit was quite a success on a number of areas. I've done a few of these kind of after actions, so to speak, on the summit, and I'd be glad to provide any details on some of the dynamics. I think that's where it's interesting. As you know, there was a lot of different topics on the agenda there. Climate change was the one that captured a lot of the world's attention, and but there was also many other topics. And, of course, there was a large focus on Africa and in a number of areas. We thought that the outcomes with regard to Africa were quite positive. 2 points on that before I jump into the health issues. For those of you who have actually taken a look at the leader statement, the G8 leaders statement, again, this is the German presidency's focus was a lot on the private sector-led development, private sector-led growth, increasing private sector investment in Africa. And we were very supportive of this focus in the G8 leader statement, simply because it's such an important engine of growth, an engine of development, an engine of addressing issues like disease and health. And I think it brought a lot of attention to the needs there, but also the promise there. A lot of people don't know that sub-Saharan African countries have been growing along with many other big economies at about 5 or 6%. And so we were very supportive and worked closely with the Germans on highlighting that element of the statement. The second area was also in the area that I think some people here would find interesting with regard to agreement on a core set of G8 development principles, and that's in the G8 leaders' statement. It might be no surprise to some of you that they mirror a lot of the Millennium Challenge Account approach to development assistance with focus on good governance, economic freedom, and ruling justly. And we thought that was another important outcome where you get the G8 to agree on core set of development principles, and that's all, again, in the Africa section. But I know what we wanted to talk about today was focused on the area of Africa health. I will make a disclaimer, seeing all the people in the room here who are experts in this area. This is one interesting thing about being the Sioux Sherpa. You become a pseudo-expert or a Sioux expert on a number of issues. And so in some ways I feel a bit intimidated to be explaining to you guys these issues, because I know that probably the vast majority of you are are experts in this area. I certainly don't claim to be, but it was an area that I focused on quite a bit over the last several months as we negotiated. So I'm ready to give you my views, but I'm sure you'll see the depth of my knowledge is pretty surface level. All that being said, what was important from the United States perspective is that, as all of you know, the issues of infectious diseases and development are very, very high priorities for the President, for the Secretary of State. And I think from our perspective, this was laid out. The President gave an important speech on development the week before the G8, and essentially he laid out what his goals were going to be with regard to the G8 when he went the next week. And it was not surprising that these goals focused a lot on HIV/AIDS and malaria. That's when he also launched the administration's climate initiative. At that point, actually about a week before moving into the summit, we thought that the ambition in the area of, even though, again, we were in agreement very much with the German focus on the private sector-led development, we thought that the ambition in terms of particularly health issues with regard to Africa could use a little more ambition. And so a couple weeks prior to the summit, we tabled some ambitious language that focused on the HIV/AIDS issues and on malaria issues. And then we started negotiating. And it was a tough negotiation to get to where we got. But prior to this, I think many of you, I'm sure all of you, were very familiar with the initiative that the president announced about doubling the next five-year commitment in terms of PEPFAR to $30 billion over the next 5 years, making this, again, the single largest international health initiative dedicated to a specific disease. What's important, though, from that perspective, if you've looked at some of the speech or when the president rolled that out, it not only is about financial aspects of the commitment, but what we think the outcomes could be. And specifically, treatment for 2.5 million people, antiretroviral treatment, prevention for more than 12 million new infections, and care for more than 12 million people, including 5 million orphans and vulnerable children. So this was the general PEPFAR 2, as we're calling it, goals, and the commitments, as you know, working obviously very closely with Congress in terms of the next 5 years of funding, doubling the commitment that we made in the first 5 years. Similarly, as many of you know, the president has been very focused on malaria, an area that as I tried to make clear in the negotiations, we think that from a public awareness perspective, that the awareness of how devastating malaria is, particularly with regard to Africa, is not nearly as well known generally as HIV/AIDS, the awareness of what that is doing to the African continent. Again, I think most of you who are aware, the president set out a very ambitious goal in his malaria initiative in June 2005. The goal was to reach 85% of the most vulnerable population and decrease malaria deaths by 50% in 15 focus countries. Okay, why am I giving you these specifics? Well, the reason I'm giving you these specifics on both the goal, the inputs and outputs of PEPFAR 2, the goals, and on the President's Malaria Initiative is because our goal coming into the G8 summit was rather simple but rather ambitious, and that was to have the rest of the G8 countries match what the United States with the Bush administration is doing with regard to PEPFAR 2 and with regard to the President's Malaria Initiative. That was the goal, both in terms of inputs and in some ways more importantly in terms of targets, which are ambitious in terms of outputs. And I won't get into all the to and fro on the negotiations, but if you look at the outcome of the G8 leaders' statement with regard to African health issues, that is exactly what was achieved. So you have a commitment by the G8 leaders, $60 billion with regard to HIV/AIDS, the other infectious diseases, but that's focused on Africa. There was some questions about that by some groups after. You also have in paragraph 58, which was very important, the outcomes that we are focused on with regard to HIV/AIDS. And that, again, if you look at the language, because I know some groups immediately went on TV and, you know, for some reason were dismissive of this, that's focused on Africa. That's 5 million antiretroviral treatment. That's the goal with regard to Africa. I think, again, you guys are the experts, but my understanding is that that's, in many people's view, that would be equivalent to universal access with regard to HIV/AIDS treatment. So we saw that as an extremely ambitious but achievable outcome, and we'll see. But and then with regard to malaria, the same thing. The statistics that I read to you in terms of the President's Malaria Initiative, essentially, if you look at the G8 statement, those are doubled. So you get the rest of G8 to commit to doubling this. And There wasn't a monetary mention, but again, it was the outcomes that we thought were so important. The final issue that, with regard to malaria, that we thought was so important was having a reference highlighting the importance of the private sector. With regard to groups like Malaria No More and other private sector, there's been a lot of press on this actually lately. There's a great New York Times article, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago on Sunday, that talked about the importance and really how the private sector is being energized with regard to malaria. And so we wanted to make sure that there was a G8 commitment to help move that along, to help spur the private sector with regard to trying to stamp out this very debilitating disease. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we were aiming for. Again, the German presidency, we want to compliment the outstanding work they did, really that everybody did, tough negotiations as always, but particularly in this area, we thought it was a very ambitious outcome. And, you know, now I think you will help hold us to task and try and actually meet these ambitious numbers, these ambitious outcomes. But look forward to your questions and any other inside baseball issues you might want to have about how the negotiations played out, but that's the general assessment.
Thank you, Dan.
Well, thank you. First of all, let me thank you, the CSS and Kaiser Foundation, for organizing this meeting. I think this is very helpful and very important. However, I think I should start by making 3 points. The first point is there was only one summit with one outcome. You presented the outcome, so there is nothing much for me left. Second, I did not attend the summit, so I cannot give you this sort of insight Dan was providing you with. And third, I share with Dan that I'm not an expert. So I'm very much intimidated. So
maybe you guys can talk to each other, and then we'll watch. No, I'm just kidding.
Having said this, I think Heiligendamm was, of course, the basis for Heiligendamm was, of course, the summits in Gleneagles and St. Petersburg, the results and the agreements achieved there. And I think as the presidency, we are highly satisfied with the outcome. And I think I should thank the U.S. for this good cooperation. I think it was a remarkable cooperation, and I think it's a real kind of a joint effort and a joint success we have achieved. From my point of view, it is important that the summit did not only focus on the financial aspects. I mean, the statement on Africa is in the German translation 26 pages long. This is quite remarkable. And it goes into quite in details, details which kind of I'm not fully sure that I understand everything, which is what is written here. So this shows to which extent the leaders were willing and committed to making things really happen and to make progress here. It is also important that the commitments on the health sector were put in a kind of a broader perspective, and that the summit actually aimed at a more comprehensive strategy. The guiding principle is, and I think this is important, that is Africa is responsible for its own development. What we as a G8, what we as Germany can offer is partnership on the basis of African ownership. This partnership requires a new form of cooperation instead of donor-recipient relationship, a partnership which is founded on shared goals, mutual responsibility, transparency, and accountability on both sides. And that's the reason why the discussion in Heiligendamm focused as on promoting peace and security, and I think there are a lot of crises. I mean, that we don't have to mention that, as well as good governance and so on and so on. And I think this is so important it is that we kind of live up to our commitments in financial terms. I think we have also to live up in terms of kind of political commitment in making sure that whatever we do, we create a framework which is conducive to a sustainable development. Thank you. I think I should leave it here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I didn't, at the front end, introduce Jen Cates, who's our fourth member of the panel here, and we're going to quickly try to gather some comments and discussion. Jen's the Vice President and Director of HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's a very close working colleague with us in the HIV AIDS Task Force at CSIS. And she's involved, she oversees all of the foundation's HIV/AIDS policy work and is involved in several international efforts to track global and domestic resource flows to fight the epidemic. We'll be hearing more from her later in this session on some of the data that she's been involved in bringing forward in this period. Let's open for discussion here. I want to invite Jen if you'd like to offer any first comments, and then we'll turn to the audience for additional comments and questions that we can come back to Dan and Johannes.
Actually, I'm going to wait on too many comments, but just throw out a couple of thoughts that maybe can lead to questions or dialogue. One that I think you just touched on, which is to think about the G8 as playing two related roles with respect to global health and HIV and infectious diseases. One is on the leadership aspect and helping to shape the agenda to some extent. The other is on the financial commitments. And clearly the two go together, and they're both important. And so I think we heard both of those things come out, and that's one we should probably talk about. And the other is this issue of broadening the look at health so that it's more it's an issue that in and of itself is focused on and commitments are made, but it's also seen as more integral to the larger G8 agenda. It's not one item on a list of items, and that's a challenge, I'm sure, especially when you're doing negotiations. And then the third thing is be interested to hear to what extent African leaders were involved in the negotiations and discussions, given their unique role that they might play at the G8, not as G8 members. So.
Okay. I'd like to invite a couple of quick comments and questions from the audience, and we'll come back. Please identify yourselves. There's a microphone here. We need the microphone for our broadcast purposes.
Hi, Kate Schechter from the American International Health Alliance. I'm wondering about the other countries that have been lower down in the PEPFAR priority. Were they discussed, and was there any sort of allocation about Eastern Europe, Asia, and Latin America?
Do you have any additional comments or questions at this point? Let me offer a couple of quick things. One, there's a couple of things in the statement that were interesting omissions that you might want to comment on. Yeah. Last year, there was a huge amount of discussion around avian influenza and global surveillance and detection. Very little this year, which I found a little surprising. Now, that might require some comment. There's a huge shortfall right now that's becoming more evident in terms of global polio efforts, and there's a large debate going on now about whether this is an eradication or containment strategy. Very little there's a single line on polio in the communique, and there's no reference to XDR-TB. Yet this has become a big rising issue. The G8 since really 96 has had a very continuous and very important role on global health. That's had quite a bit of continuity through the course, and it's built up a certain momentum and set of expectations in setting the norms and standards for this and for beginning to evolve a new form of global health diplomacy through the G8, and one that involves bringing health ministers together, in bringing key African and key rising global powers into the ranks of deliberations and the like. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about how those forms took place in your consultations. Yes. Thank you.
I think those are really good questions. I guess the main message I want to emphasize here, I mean, for example, you had St. Petersburg last year that did focus a lot on avian influenza. And I think the one issue, though, that's very important to recognize is that when something is not necessarily highlighted in the following summit, it doesn't mean that there's a loss of interest or a loss of will by the G8 leadership. And I think the difficulty is is, you know, you have a presidency, right, that sets an agenda.
It's on, but
can you hear me? Oh, maybe should I try this one?
Hello, is that coming through? Hello? This is on.
Can I turn that? Should I continue? You can hear me. It's just the webcast. Okay. Maybe they can have subtitles. I've never been accused of having a soft voice, so this should help. So those are very good questions. But it's also, it literally is a matter of, with regard to the agenda that's initially set, and then where do we go from there? So you're right. Some of these issues weren't necessarily focused on, and part of that is because we were actually going to check that we were told that this was actually one of the largest summit documents ever by the G8. So there's a lot there. It's just that every issue, particularly in the health area, it's difficult to cover them all. But I really want to underscore this because you do have this discussion where, well, boy, if we leave it off the agenda this year, will it be a signal that we're not, that the G8 leaders are not serious about it? It's not a signal. And it's literally a matter of the initial agenda that's set and then where countries are continuing to focus. And I think, for example, it's typically not the case that if there was a major focus in the summit previously, that that the following summit would have a major focus on the same issue. That's typically not the case. So I think in some ways it should not be viewed as a reflection of a lackening of leadership on some of these issues. It's literally a function of both the initial agenda as set out by whatever the presidency determines they want on the agenda, and then where other countries, in our case, it was the U.S. really wanting to focus on HIV/AIDS and malaria. Finally, with regard to the initial question, I think the G8, particularly with regard to infectious diseases, has had a tradition, both at Gleneagles and, again, under the leadership of the German presidency, focusing on Africa. And so the primary focus with regard to infectious diseases, both in the negotiations and the discussion and clearly in the final leader statement, was on Africa.
If I may add, I mean, the statement has to reflect the agenda, and the agenda cannot cover every issue. I mean, you have to make a selection, you have to make a choice. And each presidency, I think, tries to put the focus on issues which the presidency thinks is of particular importance and which needs to be highlighted during the presidency. But this does not mean that the other issues are not important or are neglected. I mean, let's not forget the summit is about 1 day and a half, more or less. I mean, one has to be realistic what can be covered and what can be discussed. The German presidency thought had actually the priority on climate change, which we think it's extremely important, and I think we have made some progress. The priority was Africa, and I think the document is, as I told you, in the English translation 22 and the German translation 26 pages, which is quite long. And on some financial and economic issues, which are the core of the G8, actually of the G8 process, in addition to all the foreign policy issues. This is quite a comprehensive agenda for 1 day and a half. And I think one has to kind of accept that not everything can be covered. Thank you.
Jen, did you have any comments?
Sure. Just to add a few thoughts. Given all of that, I think it's interesting that HIV actually has had a pretty regular spot on the agenda, at least in its discussion. We actually looked back in the first mention of HIV was in 1987 at the Venice summit in the communique there, but it really picked up in 96 in Lyon, and not just HIV but health, and has stayed on the agenda over that period. So again, I think emphasizing both roles that G8 can play, but it goes two ways. For example, one of the issues that is in the communique in the final leader statement this year is a really explicit mention of women and girls and the feminization of many of the HIV and other epidemics and how that really has to be addressed. And that's a very important thing to have in a document like this. And that was the result both of leadership on the part of donor governments, but also community leadership working back and forth. So it's two directions, but getting that kind of statement in the communique makes a difference. And it really demonstrates, I think, the importance and the elevation of that. On the financing side, the other side, clearly there was the $60 billion announcement. Some have questioned what that means, and one of the questions raised was, is it for Africa, which clearly has been stated it is going to be for Africa. What's the time period? Because that wasn't specified. And if you start to unpack it and look at it, it's a significant increase, it seems, assuming it's all new other than the U.S. component. But compared to what we know is needed, there's still a gap. Obviously, the G8 itself is not going to completely fill that gap, but it just raises this question of getting ahead of the infectious disease challenges that the world faces. One of the other things that we've been tracking in some of our work on donor funding, both for HIV and for global health more broadly, is another potential place to look moving forward. Non-G8 donors. There are several non-G8 donors who are significant contributors to both on the leadership side and financing side. For example, in our latest analysis of donor funding for HIV, the U.S. was about half of global commitments, almost half. The Netherlands was second. Ireland and Sweden are significant contributors as well. So it's important, I think, to expand our scope and thinking about the response. And one other thing I wanted to highlight that some non-G8 members have been involved in, except I think there's one that is actually a G8 member, France, is in this as well, the Oslo Ministerial Declaration, and increasing focus and attention to the issue of health as an foreign policy imperative and the need to understand health, what they said, pressing foreign policy issue of our time, one of the most important yet still broadly neglected long-term foreign policy issues. And that increased dialogue will likely, hopefully, raise the agenda, raise health on the agenda, raise HIV on the agenda as a foreign policy issue of pressing importance. So I think that will help expand the response and the understanding of the response, but keeping HIV and health on the agenda as an integral part of the agenda, clearly it has to. It ends up competing when you're doing final negotiations to get to one document for a day and a half, and that's going to be a continual challenge.
May I? Can I offer just a couple quick questions,
sure.
Quick comments, because I want to get your thoughts before you have to pull out. I mean, one thing that sort of jumps out in listening to what Dan had to say is the U.S. is comfortable with the notion. It's visibly or overtly comfortable now in seeing itself as carrying a 50% share on global health within the G8 membership and leveraging its leadership in order to try and extract a matching commitment, which that's a change in concept and comfort from the past. The second thing is that the $60 billion commitment, when you actually go and read through the text, it's leveraged against multiple goals. It's leveraged against these specific targets for access that you mentioned, which is good because universal access was not very well defined before. It's defined with a little bit more specificity this time around. And it's made clear that there needs to be credible national plans that will inform further what those access targets really are. So you made, I think there was a contribution in this document in pushing to know what are those credible plans? And until those are in place, you can't speak with final specificity on what universal access looks like. But the $60 billion was also pledged against strengthening health systems and in reaching MDGs. So there was a bundling of goals against that $60 billion number. Now, there was been a lot of controversy around the Glenn Eagles commitment on the $50 billion doubling of ODA towards Africa, and the tracking of that has fallen short, et cetera, et cetera. In a way, this was just sort of shifting the discussion onto something else. With a little bit more specificity. But when you look at the African targets, when you talk about universal access is 5 million for ARVs, we're talking about really a 400% increase, which is the desire. I mean, if you take, I'm not sure what your operating figure is in terms of numbers of people on treatment in Africa today tied to G8 action. But it's a very significant increase we're talking about in getting to 5 million in the period that you're talking about. So it's still, you know, high, very, very ambitious targets. Two other comments. One is drawing attention. You didn't mention that there was very specific attention drawn to the reality that access prevention service, mother-to-child transmission, remains at this woefully low 11% level, and that needs to be a priority target in this next phase. And I thought that was a very constructive addition to this. And there was also attention drawn to pediatric treatment and maternal and child health, which was quite useful. You also drew attention to the monitoring exercise that the German presidency is going to oversee. The G8 chronically is criticized for not having a secretariat, for not having follow-up, for not having mechanisms that are holding itself to account, for being vulnerable to excess rhetorical commitments made under the heat of international media spotlights. And then people forget until you come back and people go, wait a second. Mm-hmm. And if we could hear a bit more about this year's commitment to a monitoring exercise over the next year, how is this going to happen? There has been discussion in the past about tracking and monitoring efforts. At Glen Eagles, there was a lot of discussion around this and a lot of debate around the Africa Commission being the instrument for that. It never happened. But can you talk a little bit about that?
I'll make a few comments from what Jen said, and Steve, just to fill in kind of some of what you were talking about. I think you'll see a little bit. You had mentioned non-G8 countries. There are some references, and that was conscious, right? I mean, I think I can tell you in particular with regard to the malaria discussion, if you look at where is it? I used to have this thing memorized in my sleep. Paragraph 55 with regard to, again, mobilizing the private sector, and there's a reference to non-G8 countries, and we think that that's very important, as I think most of you do as well. Just to clarify, I don't think I actually said that we're comfortable with carrying 50% of the global load. But what we were doing was that we were trying to get the rest of the G8 to match what we believe is strong presidential leadership on these issues. And so that was the way in which me and others were pitching this as we were negotiating this document. And so, again, it's not comfortable with carrying this half of the burden, but it is saying, here's what we're doing. We would like, or here's what we're going to do with our Congress. And by the way, this, in my view, the president clearly states this all the time. This is a reflection of the generosity of the American people. I mean, these are enormous figures. And I think as American citizens, those of you who are, you have a lot to be proud of, both from what Congress has done, what the administration has done in terms of committing to these figures. I think with regard to the specificity issue, one of the things that we were very interested in is having some specificity with regard to outcomes. And you see it reflected in the document, both with regard to malaria and, as you mentioned, particularly paragraph 58 with regard to the outcomes that, as you also note, are very ambitious. They are ambitious, although we think that they're doable with the proper commitment. I think sometimes, though, it's important to recognize that this is a negotiation with eight countries, you know, with the EU in there, nine. And so you don't always get a completely clean, tight document that that has that sets out an exact roadmap on every issue. But we were relatively pleased, as you noted, Steve, with regard to some of the specificity on outcomes, because we think that then you can be held accountable. And the monitoring mechanism from the U.S. perspective is an important component to maintaining the credibility of the G8 on meeting these commitments. And, you know, they're not always easy to meet. And there were some countries that were more reluctant to sign on to these commitments than others. And part of what I know all of you do, probably better than most everybody else, is to try and hold the governments to account. And I think that's it's actually really useful. So, but again, with regard to the specificity, there was a conscious effort to make things specific and outcome oriented because it is something that can be measured.
What about
on the specifics of that? I think we're still working on elements of that. I think the important point was, though, to acknowledge the importance of it.
And this is something the German presidency.
Yeah. I mean, I can't give you the details now how this will work, but actually this is something we consider important because, as you said, G8 has the reputation of being big in rhetoric but not always very big in action. And this is something we want to change by kind of establishing a monitoring mechanism. But just a short word on EU contribution, since we are for another two or three days still the presidency of the EU. I mean, you have to add up all the contributions of the EU countries and the Commission, of course. And if you do that, for example, to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, you will see that the EU, all the EU countries, including the EU Commission, is, of course, the much, with a great distance, the largest provider of help and assistance. Sorry, but it's a matter of fact. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Peg Willingham with the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, and I wanted to ask Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Heindel about how can we as global health advocates and implementers best influence you all in looking ahead to Japan or looking at the things that made you add things into your document. What was the most effective way for groups like ours to communicate and influence you all? Thank you.
I can tell you from my perspective, I think groups the groups represented here play an extremely important role, critical in a lot of ways. And I think one of the most important ways is to as we discussed earlier, is to keep the commitments, our feet to the fire, so to speak. The commitments that are made, you know, they need to be met. And I think most governments, when they commit, look, I can tell you from at least my experience, nobody does this lightly. These are really, really difficult negotiations. A lot goes into it, a lot of thinking, a lot of checking back with the highest levels of government to make sure the countries are ready to commit what's in these documents. And so I think there's a sincerity in these documents. People don't just commit to them and say, okay, no one will remember. I mean, there's a sincerity and a commitment to meet this. But you know, governments sometimes have problems. And I think working with the governments and also calling, I think, from an education standpoint, raising issues that perhaps, you know, senior government officials are not aware of in the health area, trying to get them on the agenda is also very important. But look, I want to commend all of you for what you do, because in a lot of ways this is a partnership in some ways with the governments and what the NGOs and the private sector is doing in this area is really, all three are vitally important. So I would just hold our feet to the fire.
I think I just can join you. I mean, discussion at what action of governments is reflected or reflects what reflects public discussion, and that's, you have to keep up the public discussion. You have to kind of raise the issues, and then this will somehow kind of feed in what governments do and what governments will decide and so on. I mean,
did we get any indication of how the Japanese are likely to use their presidency in 2008 with respect to health? Were there indications, expressions at Heiligendamm that gave us any sense of where the Japanese are likely to move?
Because they've signaled their interest in climate change as a focus, but I'm not clear on how.
You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but my own view is it's never too early to start reaching out to them. In terms of working on the agenda. But I don't know. I did not, or I don't recall any specific focus on where they're going to be focused.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, a couple of questions have touched on George Moose from George Washington University. A couple of questions have touched on the involvement of African leaders, particularly at the summit. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about whether this is a G8 agenda, or to what extent does it really reflect a shared agenda, and what were the commitments on the other side? Now, you do have a number of African leaders there who have not always been in the forefront in terms of their commitment on HIV/AIDS. And I'd just like to hear you talk a little bit about their engagement and what do you expect of them in this process? Thanks.
I'll take that very quickly. And I think Johannes' comment at the outset was a really important one. And I think the Germans did a great job in throughout the text of this is underscoring the importance of the notion of partnership on these issues. And it's reflected in some of the words here. I mean, you see particularly with regard to paragraph 58 that does lay out the financial commitment, but immediately after that commitment's made, it talks about these contributions will supplement efforts by African governments, right? I mean, so the importance of that partnership and the notion that this can't be where it's going to be a one-way kind of track to addressing health issues, I think is really laid throughout the statement. And I think, and I know in our discussions, it was very, very important to make sure that the document reflected a partnership and a support for what these countries were doing. And so I think it's a great point that you raised, but it's the critical point, really, in a lot of ways. But I think the document does a pretty good job of reflecting that important notion of partnership.
Dan, thank you so much on behalf of everyone here. We realize.
And again, I apologize for having to peel off here, but don't want to miss the boss's swearing in. So, thank you very much, and thank you again for your commitment to these issues. Sorry, I didn't.
No.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so
much.
Johannes, while we have you here, if we can talk for just a few more minutes, on a related issue, did you have any insights into the presence of newly elected Nigerian President Yar'Adua at the summit. This was an issue, this was a quite sensitive issue for your government and for ours and others. President came into office, inaugurated end of May on the strength of the April 21 elections, which were sort of widely condemned as fraudulent and rigged and subject to lots of violent intimidation and manipulation and abuse and fraud. And President Merkel was among the most outspoken in the early days in saying that this was something that was going to bring into question the whole sort of credibility and standing of this government. And then a decision was taken that the president would be welcomed to the G8 summit, and that was an advisable course. And I think that was something that was agreed among the G8 membership. This wasn't simply a decision, I believe, of your government alone. Did you have any commentary on sort of how that piece went over the course of the summit?
Well, I can't give you any details. I don't know. But as a general remark, I would say in this case you always have to kind of to make a choice between kind of moral purism and getting things done. And you can't get things done without partners on the spot. And, well, that's a choice you are confronted with, and then you have to make a decision.
No, I didn't. Yeah, no, I realize that. Maybe I should elaborate a little further. I mean, when then-Governor Yar'Adua was campaigning for office, there were many efforts to engage him by the diplomatic corps within Nigeria. There were many efforts made by the EU member states, in particular, that failed. In fact, by the time he was elected April 21st, the only ambassador that he had any single conversation with was U.S. Ambassador John Campbell. This was a person who was unknown to the European community, to many of, to the African diplomatic corps as well. And so his appearance there was quite important in many respects. And were there any developments around that appearance that were of note? I didn't see anything in the journalistic coverage of the summit, nor necessarily was it going to be a very visible or conspicuous part.
Well, I simply didn't know because I was here in Washington. I didn't follow that closely, but I think in the end, I think it boils down to the kind of decision I mentioned
to engage and
to get engaged and to find a kind of a balanced approach to the whole thing and so on.
Yeah. Jen?
Actually, I'm going to raise three other things that maybe we can talk about or just as comments, not related to that. The first is there was discussion in the communique and in the leadership statement about the Global Fund, so we might want to talk about the was that emphasis the appropriate emphasis, but essentially the statement was that there was a recognition of the need for the Global Fund to continue to be supported and the increased resource needs that it will face and support for the replenishment conference that will be in Germany in just a couple of months. So that was in the statement. The second is thinking about Japan and looking forward, and this goes to Peg's question a little bit. For those of you who have been involved in the G8 summits in different ways, you know that the work of the G8 summit is actually mostly now and all the way through now till the next summit, and then there's that day and a half. There's a lot of months of discussions and negotiations that take place. So a lot will become apparent, but Japan itself is well known for the Okinawa 2000 summit raising infectious diseases as a major platform issue at that summit, which was quite important, and announcing a big five-year initiative at the time that ran through 2005. In last year, I believe, Japan announced a new health and development initiative to sort of be not at the same level, but it's sort of PEPFAR 2 in going forward. And I think there's still waiting to see a little bit about what that will be. But Japan does already have a history of making infectious diseases a priority at the G8 summit. So I think that's a good sign, and it will they won't forget that. I doubt they would. So we'll hopefully see signs of that. And the last thing is just going back to ambitious goals and outcomes and thinking ahead. And I just wanted to underscore what the stakes really are. Tomorrow, the Global HIV Prevention Working Group, which is an organization of international experts, about 50, that's co-convened by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Gates Foundation, we're releasing our fifth report, and it's focusing on prevention scale-up. What does prevention scale-up mean for HIV, and what are the stakes? And one of the things that we found in a new analysis that was commissioned for this report is that if current trends continue, there could be 60 million more HIV infections between right around now to 2015. If there's a tremendous scale-up, the kind of scale-up that many experts believe would be needed over that period, about half of those could be prevented. So the stakes are really high, and getting ahead of the HIV epidemic, let alone others, is a critical challenge.
Have any other comments or questions? On the Japanese piece, the Japanese have really not given us a whole lot of detail on that most recent development, most recent initiative. And it's very likely that what we're going to see is something that's very Asia-centric or very Asia-focused, and less Africa focused, and what that means in practice, we could discuss, but it would become an exercise more speculative than anything else. But I think there will be a strong inclination to attempt to assert a regional leadership role within Asia. I mean, that even in the Okinawa period, that was in the Okinawa summit. If you go back and look at that, that was a dominant theme from Okinawa. It was a very emphatic part. There's been problems of follow-through on the financial commitment side at different points, and there's been an instability and uncertainty in the sort of relations with the Diet on many of these commitments that have also complicated things. And I'm not sure sort of where that stands, but I also think it unlikely that we're going to see major big-ticket initiatives launched, but that there will be a sequence of things that will have a very specific reference to the regional environment. Not that there's going to be a walk back entirely from Africa, but I think that there would be a different emphasis there. If there's no other comment, yes.
Sure. I'll just, to piggyback with what was being said, I'm sure people in the room know that PEPFAR has actually already reached $5.4 billion. So it's kind of a misnomer to continue calling this commitment a doubling. So that would be about 50 less, it would be less than doubling to reach $50 billion, which would help prevent these 30 million new infections. And I'm really, sorry about that. I'm really wondering why in the final text the G8 countries committed to $60 billion over the coming years and didn't stick with that, you know, by 2010 as we've been using for universal access. And secondly, I just also want to be part of this discussion in motivating each other to think creatively about how to get our elected officials here to really be champions for infectious diseases at the upcoming summit, because I think they, you know, have a high stake with Japanese-U.S.-Japan relations, and I think that we should all make sure that TB, AIDS, and malaria continue to be a priority at the G8. So I'd like to hear those issues addressed, please.
John, you want to lead off?
I can't, since I was not, and I mean, it's a pity that Dan has left because he was in hiding them. I was not, and so I can't tell you how the height came to that we have got formulation over the coming years. With regard to Japan, I think, I'm not so surprised that for the time being we don't know exactly what the Japanese government is up to, because, I mean, the summit was not that long ago, and we have to wait a little bit, yeah. But I think, I have no idea. But I think the focus should not be so much on the next summit, but it should be on implementing what has been agreed in Heiligendamm. And I think this is one of the problems I see, that we always kind of produce a lot of papers and then produce new commitments, but we forget about implementing that what has been agreed. And I think this should be actually your focus. You should kind of monitor us, the governments, whether we live up to our commitments and whether we really implement what has been agreed. That would be my simple answer.
I think, you know, the question you raise, there's been a rising level of disquiet since Glenn Eagles about the magnitude of commitments and whether they were credible or not, or whether they were convenient poses to take, credible in the sense of as an aspiration, but not so credible in terms of the delivery of the funding in the time frame involved. And the ever since St. Petersburg, I think there's been a level of reflection on and a hesitation towards reaching towards ever bigger commitments. And when you made this point about how the $60 billion was over the coming years versus a specific target, I took that as a reflection of the level of discomfort over having made those commitments in Glen Eagles, and now a couple of years on, seeing the shortfall, and the Putin government started, I think, this process of saying, "No, wait a second. There's a proliferation of commitments made. There's a lack of discipline in reviewing the implementation and compliance with those." And you simply cannot be allowing yourself to be responding to the momentary pressures coming out of media or the like in making yet new higher-level commitments unless you're really serious about meeting those. And if you're not serious about meeting those, you're ultimately going to discredit the reputation or the integrity of the institution itself. And there's been a lot of debate going on internally within the G8 as well as within the sort of media. You had a question?
I'm Bob Ferris. I'm with USAID's Office of HIV/AIDS, and I co-chair PEPFAR's Adult Treatment Technical Working Group. And I think that there's a lot of movement going in treatment these days, and there's a lot of extraordinary people out there working very hard. And just that your questions are excellent in regards to the money. But just to emphasize that it's not just an issue of money out there right now in terms of, you know, human resources and people in the field, really dedicated people in the field. But actually, to come back to money, I had a question regarding, I know a lot of the mechanisms that the U.S. government is using for the deputy minister, what do you foresee the German government using as ways of getting funding to Africa? What mechanisms?
Well, there are a lot of mechanisms. I mean, we are giving a lot of money to the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria. Then, of course, we have a lot of bilateral programs. And, of course, we are kind of funding programs of the African governments which look for money and which we consider kind of good and helpful. There is no kind of, there are a lot of kind of a broad range of approaches and programs. But let me come back to the issue which was mentioned before. I'm a little bit troubled by the strong focus on money. I mean, look at Darfur. Darfur is not a question of money. It's a question of creating stability by politics. And I think this is as important as giving money to Africa. And in so far, I would strongly suggest that we can, as important it is to come up with money and to fulfill the commitments which have been made in hiding them, it is equally important to create framework conditions in Africa which are conducive to a kind of sustainable development, because this is actually as important for global health or for health than, let's say, some very focused programs.
Just to add one thing specific to your question, which might be a resource that could be helpful to that question and just the broader issue of the different roles that donors are playing or mechanisms that they use, we developed a couple pages matrix on that very issue about a year ago. It's on our website that basically looks at the major donors and tries to analyze what, not the amounts, because again, it's not all about money, but how donors are choosing to provide. This was HIV-specific aid, but it would speak to the larger strategies. So some taking more of a multilateral approach, some taking more of a bilateral approach, some working more directly with NGOs, some with governments, and the various relationships and ways that that's organized. So if that's of interest to anyone, we have that on the Kaiser website.
Hi, I'm Jenny Quick with PSI. And my question is sparked by what Jen said about the advantages of scaling up prevention efforts. And I'm wondering if you feel that the G8 has been striking the right balance between prevention on the one hand and care and treatment on the other hand.
Why don't we take the other question also, please?
Sure. I'm Kathy Salvaggio with the International Center for Research on Women. And I want to commend the German government in particular for taking the initiative to include a number of paragraphs in the final communique that address gender and women. It seemed to me from our vantage point that the Germans were quite responsive on this, and we had difficulty getting a lot of responsiveness to those issues in our own U.S. government, and that was unfortunate. At the same time, some people in our community have sort of looked at that very good language which speaks about the need to address violence against women, the particular vulnerabilities of adolescent girls, and a whole range of other very essential issues that are part of the you know, critical to preventing HIV. And there are no numbers, there's no funding commitments there, you know, but funding aside, no targets, nothing firm there to really hold governments accountable to. So I'm kind of wondering if you can reflect on how you see that language going forward, what's going to happen there.
Josh.
I can't talk on behalf of the G8. I can only talk on behalf of my government. And actually, we consider gender equality as a key of addressing this issue. And, in the paper which was prepared for this event, there is one paragraph on promoting gender equality, and let me read it. The German government regards combating gender inequalities as a key element of HIV-AIDS control. For the following reasons: biological vulnerability, lack of access to information, women in many countries have less access to education and so on, that goes without saying, power relations in sexual relationships, women's lower social status, economic dependency, it goes without saying, and lack of opportunities for political participation. This is all very important. But at the same time, this is sort of a long-term approach. This is not an approach which you can kind of fix, where you can make a quick fix. You have to kind of a long-term approach. This has a lot to do with societies and so on. So it might be realistic that there are no concrete targets in the text, but this does not mean that we would kind of not take this issue very seriously. This is one of the most important issues on our agenda and on which we focus very much. Okay.
Well, there were some, first of all, I think the language was, the strength of language and the detail of the language in describing the impact and the significance of gender was a step beyond where the G8 had gone up to now, and that was very commendable. As far as the targets, there was putting the focus on the PMTC at 11% coverage and saying, and making very clear just how woeful that coverage level is, particularly when you think back to just a few years ago when prevention of mother and child transmission was such a hot focus of effort, and then to today come back and go, look, this is 11% coverage. And I think that was important. I think saying that pediatric treatment is not gender, but talking about maternal health, talk about voluntary family planning as a set of interventions in which a specific shortfall, and which was a dollar amount, it was a $1.5 billion shortfall, was also useful. But you're right. Overall, there were not the kind of targets that we saw on the malaria and we saw on the sort of access ARV access issues. The first question that Jenny raised about the balance of prevention treatment, that issue. I don't know if Jen, if you agree with this. It seemed to me that the focus on access took front seat. There was no strong call saying that for a renewed effort or an elevation of the prevention agenda as a central priority. In other words, there wasn't the argument made that you might have anticipated about you can't spend your way out of this epidemic and the prevention agenda is slipping. And I don't know what your thought is on that.
And that didn't seem to be a strong emphasis in the document. But I think the larger question of is it there the right balance? That's a hard one to answer. But I do think all the data that we can look at indicate we're not getting ahead of this epidemic. That is just the reality. Yet at the same time, it's not a failure of prevention. And I think that's very critical. And what the report tomorrow is going to say is that if we look at the treatment access in a way as a success, I mean, we're certainly not reaching the coverage levels that we need to reach with treatment, but the global community has increased access significantly, and we all have been looking at that. And it shows what a commitment like that globally, both with partners on the ground, with affected country governments, with community-based organizations, with donors, can really do. That same level of commitment and has not necessarily been applied to prevention at the same way for a variety of reasons. Getting ahead of something is much more challenging to translate into specific things than providing treatment directly. But what the report looks specifically at the scale-up issue and defines scale-up. It analyzes interventions that have been shown to be highly effective interventions, and there's a whole range of them for prevention, but basically concludes that they haven't been scaled up. And what by that meaning the right interventions reaching the right people at the right intensity for the sustained amount of time. That hasn't happened. Where that has happened in the cases where it has, in the countries where it has, for the interventions where it's been properly channeled, there have been successes. So there's evidence of impact. But it's just the sustained level of effort. So that's one of the strong statements that the report is going to make, but it speaks to this larger challenge that I think the global community is really facing. It's the need to get ahead of HIV in particular. Epidemics are the kinds of things you have to get ahead of, and that's a very hard thing to translate into programs and activities. I think you see there's a larger prevention dialogue happening more broadly, I believe, but not necessarily coming through in this. So.
Thank you. We've been going on for some time. I think we should probably wrap this up. There's one issue that did not come forward, which I just want to make reference to, which is, there was very muted reference in this document to the whole emerging debate around pricing on second-line therapy for ARVs. The issue was only flagged that there should be a review of price policies with regard to second-line drugs. There was no hortatory language. There was no fill-out language defining sort of the way in which this issue is likely to play itself through. That was a little surprising. I would have anticipated. I would have predicted that the issue would have been much more front and center by this point. That the G8 membership would have seen it as something that was potentially quite divisive and difficult and complicated to deal with. Maybe that's something to be put forward for next year's summit. We'll see. We'll see where that is. Johannes, do you have any closing comments you wish to offer?
Thank you.
Jen? Well, on behalf of all of our speakers, thank you all for coming.